Orson Welles was an outsized personality, an undisputed genius whose self-mythologizing shaped how we continue to view his life and his art. Now being published in this centennial year of Welles' birth and the 30th anniversary of his death, as well as the 75th anniversary of his masterpiece Citizen Kane, there's the book Young Orson, The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane. It recasts Welles' formative years as an artist through revelations and new interpretations of long-accepted facts. Film biographer Patrick McGilligan, whose award-winning books include Lives of Alfred Hitchcock and Fritz Lang, sorts through a decade of research, including access to new archival material and previously unpublished private correspondence, to offer a new account of the artist and the man. Patrick McGilligan is the author of Alfred Hitchcock, A Life of Darkness and Light, Fritz Lang, The Nature of the Beast, and the new book, Young Orson, The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane. And we welcome Patrick McGilligan to the roundtable this morning. Patrick, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
It is very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to this young life of Orson Welles?
Well, to be honest, I've done a lot of books where I went out to Hollywood and did a lot of interviews. And I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And my last book was about a director born in Wisconsin, Nicholas Ray. And I was looking around for another subject where I could do a lot of the work close to home. And then it occurred to me that Orson was born down the road in Kenosha and lived there for about 3 years. And then he lived in Chicago and Highland Park and Woodstock, Illinois, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, and Madison, Wisconsin, and Northern Wisconsin. And that much of this took place during, as you say, the formative years and the years leading up to Citizen Kane. And I had the idea that this period of his life, although written about extensively in other books, had never really been researched in a journalistic fashion, and that I could show this period of his life as a foreshadowing of Citizen Kane, and as we watch his life unfold, in a sense, we're watching the film take shape.
Let us begin with his life in Kenosha. He is the son of an alcoholic and a radical musician.
Let me put it this way. His birth is announced on the front page of the Kenosha newspaper, which I discovered when I read about 20 years of microfilm in the public library there, because the newspaper is not electronically indexed. And his father was not an alcoholic at the time that he was born, and I go into some depth in my book as to how much of an alcoholic he actually was. I think that's part of the mythology, and probably something that was handed down to Orson as fact. So I find in my book that actually Orson is quite truthful about a lot of things, especially when he is the witness, as opposed to someone else having told him something. His father was a very, very prominent businessman, one of the executives of one of the leading brass factories in town at the time that Kenosha was a big brass factory city. And he was actually so prominent in the town that he was rumored at one point to be a consensus candidate for mayor as a liberal Republican, because the whole family had liberal Republican politics at that time. And he was also an inventor. He held about a dozen patents, and I go into this in my book and explain that he was actually a very clever inventor, doing things that were actually quite commercial and quite valuable at the time to what he was doing as a businessman, but also to the trade in general. And his mother, who the father met in Chicago, was, as you say, a musician. She was a pianist, and she was a classical pianist, but she's quite willing to play John Philip Sousa at parties, and she could play anything. And like Orson, actually, she could and would do anything for entertainment or for folks. And so we see when they move to Kenosha after they get married, after the turn of the century, we see her begin to direct plays. We begin to see her act in plays. It's a really fascinating period of Orson's life before he's born, again, really influencing him through his parents, because we see that, for example, he's not the first Welles to shake the hand of an American president. His mother was. And that he's not the first Welles to appear in motion picture. His parents did. And they were quite well-known and prominent in Kenosha. His mother was the first elected public official, first female on the school board in the state of Wisconsin and in Kenosha, and prominent as a suffragette as well as a performer, and very, very active in politics and in community politics in general. Now, after Orson was born in 1915, it begins a period of family strife and disillusionment with living in Kenosha. And in 1918, they moved to Chicago. And then a breakup between his parents soon follows. They don't divorce. They never divorce. But they live separately and begin to share custody of Orson.
What brought the young Orson Welles as a teenager to theater?
Well, really through his mother and father, who were very, very avid theatergoers, and not just theatergoers in Kenosha, but they would take the train down to Chicago, they would take the train up to Milwaukee, and they had a habit always of going backstage and shaking the hands of the performers, and then inviting them over for dinner if they were in Kenosha, or inviting them for dinner if they were in Chicago, and becoming friends with them, and becoming very friendly with a lot of very famous touring performers at that point in time, not just actors and actresses, but actor managers who put on Shakespeare plays, magicians, all kinds of traveling performers. So Orson was at an early age being exposed to all these very interesting and sometimes famous people, going backstage, for example, in Chicago with his parents to shake the hand of Sarah Bernhardt on one of her last American tours. And it's an important aspect of his early upbringing that in a small town like Kenosha, or a small city like Kenosha, they very much revered these actor managers who went on tour endlessly producing Shakespeare and other classical works for basically the sticks. And these people were great celebrities. You see them mentioned in The Magnificent Ambersons, Booth Tarkington's novel that Orson later filmed, that these people were great celebrities in Orson's household, and he collected their names and information about them the same way boys in a later era might collect baseball cards and know all about their sports heroes. And if you mentioned the names of one of these people, like Sir Ben Greet or something, who's one of the last of these touring famous actor managers, he could reel off an encyclopedic knowledge about them. And in most cases, he had met them because he had seen them perform and gone backstage and shaked their hands. So by the time, before he's a teenager, he knows Shakespeare backwards and forwards and is performing it in his living room and doing his own versions of plays.
By 19 years old, he has published a book on Shakespeare. At 20, he is directing an all-black production of Macbeth in Harlem. And by the next year, he is producing a musical, The Cradle Will Rock, which, as you point out, becomes a landmark production.
Yes, and actually these are all markers on various roads for him, markers on the road to celebrity, markers on the road to fruition with his talent, markers on the road politically, because he was very progressive, left liberal politically, just as his mother had been and his father had been. They were people who actually spoke at public rallies for various causes, and he learned this from the cradle as well. And things like the Voodoo Macbeth awakened him to problems of black people in America. Things like the Workers' Musical that he put on for the Federal Theater Project and then was canceled, Cradle Will Rock, you know, woke him up to labor issues. And all along, he's becoming more and more famous. And actually, this is the year that you talk about this year with Voodoo Macbeth and following that, not right away, but later, Cradle Will Rock, are the years that he really rises to the top in New York, and his name is on everybody's lips, both in theater columns and society columns, as the hot kid in town. And they would call him the boy genius, the boy wonder, the hot kid in town.
And then comes the Mercury Theater. How did that come to be founded and developed, which ultimately, of course, led to War of the Worlds?
Yeah, well, you know, like I say, Orson had this idea in his head of being an actor manager from boyhood. And really, that's an idea that influences him throughout his entire life, where he becomes a kind of itinerant actor manager going around the world, collecting ragtag ensembles around him and working on various projects, plays and films, sometimes that were not completed for lack of money. And in New York, he got together with a producer, young producer by the name of John Houseman, about 10 years older than him, but nonetheless a young producer. And they had this success with the Voodoo Macbeth. Then they decided to leave the Federal Theater Project, and they were allowed to form their own autonomous company within the Federal Theater Project. And then because of Cradle Will Rock, they left the Federal Theater Project. And as I said, Orson's dream always was to have his own company. And together, they formed something called the Mercury Theater, and they began to put on plays like a Shakespeare version, a modern-dress Shakespeare version of Julius Caesar, which really rocked the town and really modernized theater in a lot of ways. It was very sensational. And around them, they collected a group of young, mostly unknown or up-and-coming young actors, people like Joseph Cotten, Norman Lloyd, who's still alive today, was in Amy Schumer's most recent film, and other people who were destined to have glittering careers in stage and screen. And they formed this Mercury Theater Ensemble, and they began to put on plays. And at the same time, all along, Orson had been rising up in radio. And the network people had been watching him, and they offered him his own program. So he took some of the Mercury Theater stage people into the Mercury Theater radio production group, but some were there all along as radio people that were his friends. And together, this group blended, becomes the group that eventually he takes with him to Hollywood to make Citizen Kane. And that's part of the story. And it's one of the great things about Orson is that he could collect people around him and find remarkable talent within people that other people may not have noticed as early or as easily. And sometimes these people followed, some of that Mercury Theater group followed him along on various projects throughout the rest of his life and career, so that people like Joseph Cotten are in his last, you know, unfinished works and are still his very good friends.
How unprecedented is it to have, at this time, a 24-year-old man go to Hollywood, sign a contract, which ultimately gives him complete freedom, not only as a writer, not only as a director, not only as a producer, but also a star?
Well, at that age, without having directed a film, it was extremely rare, if not unique. And there was a lot of resentment in Hollywood from the established columnists and some of the conservative trade press to the idea of giving a young guy like that, you know, what they called, you know, a contract that gave him carte blanche as producer, director, writer, and star, because he was supposed to star in his first film. And so there was a lot of sniping at him in the press. It's one of the things that he had to fight and struggle against. And at the same time, he's often giving interviews that backfire on him, because he was quite capable of grandstanding or saying negative things about Hollywood people in print. But it's an important part of the story that the guy who gave him this contract, an RKO head of RKO at the time, a guy by the name of George Schaefer, he's not one of the famous Hollywood moguls who ran studios. He was actually had risen up through sales ranks and had managed to take over RKO just at this period of time. And he did offer carte blanche or autonomous contracts to numerous interesting people that he felt would bring some distinction to the studio. And he really backed Orson to the hilt. He backed him to the hilt on Citizen Kane when time and again there was difficulty either with the possible censorship or with the subject of the film, which a lot of people thought was too closely tied to William Randolph Hearst, and eventually the final cut. And within the studio and within Hollywood, there was constant resistance to this guy backing Orson to the hilt. But they had a great relationship, and that's one of the reasons why Citizen Kane was the kind of film that it was, which was made really very personally, but also with a lot of control by this young guy, because the studio had backed him to the hilt. And that never happened again, because by the time of his second film, The Magnificent Ambersons, Schaefer was in a rocky position, and while that film was in post-production, he was ousted, never to return to the head of a studio. So he only had a brief reign, but it's one of the reasons why we have Citizen Kane.
At what point after the contract was inked did all of the seeds start to be planted for Citizen Kane in Orson Welles' mind?
Well, the truth is that the seeds were planted in his boyhood, and you see this in my story, in my life story up to the point where Citizen Kane starts filming in various ways. You see him, he was an opera nut. He knew operas backwards and forwards. He went to first nights because he was friends with all the Chicago newsmen through his mother and father. And, for example, at the prep school, they used to have a block of tickets for all of the Chicago opera productions and all the visiting opera productions because they were an elite prep school. And when they took the train in on the weekends to see the operas, the boys fought to sit next to Orson because he would recount the plot and tell you all about the opera on the way in so that people could understand it when it was sung to them in a foreign language. So he really knew opera. He really knew the newspaper world. He became very good friends with an elder statesman among the Chicago press, by a guy by the name of Ashton Stevens, who was then at that point in time probably one of America's leading drama critics. A drama critic, by the way, who had taught banjo to William Randolph Hearst and used to tell William Randolph Hearst stories all the time, and also knew everything else, knew art, knew opera. So he would go, for example, on a trip to New York, he and Orson would go to the Museum of Modern Art together, to the exhibit that was ongoing, and discuss it between themselves. And they became really great friends, and almost that group of newsmen became like a surrogate family, and Ashton Stevens became like a surrogate father because Orson's own parents were dead by the time he was 16. And then Ashton Stevens eventually becomes the model for the character that Joseph Cotten plays in Citizen Kane. So you see a lot of what happens in Citizen Kane germinating in various ways during the years of his boyhood, the years in Broadway and radio leading up to Hollywood. And then he meets a man by the name of Herman J. Mankiewicz, who collaborates with him, and they have this idea for a story about a kind of tycoon like William Randolph Hearst, who has a newspaper empire, who gets involved with opera, and whose final word is Rosebud, and that reflects upon a life in which he's never had love and has been taken away from his parents at an early age, just like Orson.
What do you hope people ultimately get out of the book in understanding this man who is very complex?
Well, the book is quite long, and it's hard to synopsize, and it actually ends with the first take of Citizen Kane, and then there's one final chapter that takes place on the last day of his life. I think the book gives you a sympathy and understanding of him that hadn't existed before now. This is a guy who really had to struggle against the deaths of his parents, his mother when he's 10 or 11, his father when he's 16, and then also struggle with the idea that when his father died, on the headlines in the Chicago papers was that now he was a rich boy. He had a wealthy trust fund set aside for himself. Money that I trace in the book down to a few months before Citizen Kane starts shooting, when he finally gets his money at the age of 25, the same age as Charles Foster Kane gets his money in Citizen Kane, and the money is reduced to a couple thousand dollars. And so he has a very, very complicated relationship to money throughout his career, throughout his life. Money goes through his fingers. It's elusive. And yet he scoffs at it, too. He lived big, as you say. He had a great time, and he was constantly broke and then rich the next day and then broke the next day. So all of these aspects of his psychology, some of which I think would have crippled other people, certainly to lose your parents. And he loved his parents and thought of them as mythically wonderful. Those are his words. To have lost them and to have the soul of an artist, which is what he was taught to have in his life from his parents when he was young, to have the soul of an artist and to be questing after something that was artistic for his entire life. All of this is much more sympathetic and understandable when you look at his early years leading up to Citizen Kane.
On the cover of Time magazine at the age of 23, how did he handle fame?
Well, he himself said on the Merv Griffin Show on the last day of his life, which is covered in the last chapter of my book, that he's not proud of everything he did and that he misbehaved, and he felt bad about doing things, particularly to people who were good to him, friends, lovers, associates. And at times, he was very egomaniacal and insisted upon doing things in such a way as to make it very difficult for everyone else around him. But at other times, and Merv Griffin asks him on that talk show of on the last day of his life, is he a happy man? And he kind of winces at the question. He says he wouldn't describe himself as a happy man, but he had had joy every day of his life at some time. And that's the kind of person he was, even when you were exasperated by him, that he brought joy to other people. He brought joy to people by his presence often, because he had a magnificent personality that was extremely fun and fun-loving. And he also brought joy to people by getting the best out of them creatively in the work he did with them. So it's true of anyone. He had happiness, he had unhappiness. And the word luck in the title is very important, because he said to Merv Griffin very sincerely, and he said it to many people over the years, that his life and his career owed a lot to luck, both to bad luck, such as losing his parents, and good luck. And he had both at different times.
Well, the name of the book is Young Orson, The Years of Luck and Genius on the Path to Citizen Kane. It is published by Harper. Patrick McGilligan, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is Young Orson, and it is published by Harper. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.